Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
On a cold Monday morning, 3 days into the new millennium, I left Dublin Airport for Auckland and onwards to Tonga and Nauru in the South Pacific. My odyssey was part of a global canvassing campaign directed by the Department of Foreign Affairs to secure Ireland's election to the UN Security Council in 2001. To win one of the two rotating seats available to the Western European and others group in the UN, we needed the votes of two-thirds of the then UN membership of 173 states. Our opponents were Norway and Italy. Canvassing was focused principally on UN headquarters in New York, where our UN mission ran the front-of-house lobbying campaign. Our small network of embassies supported this, but for those many countries where Ireland had no representation, six envoys, of which I was one, had the task of getting face time with decision makers in governments and foreign ministries, many of whom had scant knowledge of Ireland, and persuading them that Ireland deserved and needed their votes. My first stop was Nuku'alofa, capital of Tonga. The first sunrise of the new millennium had dawned in Tonga. The Irish Times' very first edition of the year 2000 carried an article on millennium celebrations around the world, including Tonga's. In Dublin Airport, I folded a spare copy into my travel bag. I landed in Nuku'alofa on the 5th of January 2000. My Tongan Foreign Ministry contact assured me that I would get a meeting with the Foreign Minister. In the aristocratic and hierarchical Tongan system, however, all decisions of consequence were made by the king, Tuafafu Tupu. "Any chance of a courtesy call on His Majesty?" I asked. My minder looked at me, aghast. Clearly this presumptuous request was out of the question. I told him I had a special gift for His Majesty, the Millennium Supplement from the Irish Times, with an article providing a first-hand account of celebrations in Tonga. His Majesty would surely want to see this unique and timely coverage. Reluctantly, he agreed to refer my request to royal protocol, but he reminded me that His Majesty did not receive officials, however far they might have travelled. Early the following morning, the phone rang in my hotel room. It was my foreign ministry minder. "Get dressed. His Majesty has asked that you join him for breakfast." I have good memories of that meeting. We sat in the warm sunshine and chatted. This genial, elderly king, who had ruled his remote island kingdom since 1965, had visited Ireland once and been to Short's aircraft factory in Belfast. He spoke of his late mother, Queen Salote, who in 1953 attended the coronation of Queen Elizabeth and refused to have the hood raised on her horse-drawn carriage when it began to rain. This mark of respect endeared her to spectators. He read the Irish Times article I'd brought him, chuckling at a reference to the Tongan Surfers Association surfing the first wave of the millennium at midnight. I told him of Ireland's Security Council bid, stressing the shared concerns of small island states. He would, he assured me, have a word with the Prime Minister. Leaving that meeting, I felt quietly confident we had Tonga's vote. From Tonga, I made my way to Nauru in Micronesia, the world's smallest island nation. The President, René Harris, a bluff, outspoken, combative politician, listened in silence while I told him of our election bid. He made no reply. Perhaps he hadn't heard of Ireland. I produced a pocket-sized map of Europe to show him our location and started afresh. "Stop," he barked. "What do you think keeps me sane on this godforsaken island?" I was at a loss. Clearly I had caught him on a bad day. "The music of Daniel O'Donnell," he told me wistfully. Surely another vote in the bag. 10 months later, on a warm Tuesday in early October, I was in New York to see how the UN would vote. The expectations in the corridors at UN headquarters was that Norway would top the poll, with the second seat closely fought between Ireland and Italy. It could go either way. To our surprise and great delight, Ireland topped the poll on the first count with 130 votes. Norway came second with 115. By the third ballot, Italy's 94 had dropped to 57 votes. The ballot is secret, but in the clamour and excitement that followed the vote, I saw the ambassadors of Tonga and Nauru cross the General Assembly floor to join the throng surrounding Ireland's UN representative, Richard Ryan. Watching them, I knew, for certain, that Tonga and Nauru and the Irish Times and Daniel O'Donnell had delivered. There were other moments in that long campaign, but my visits to Tonga and Nauru in the Millennium New Year have a special place in my memory. King Taupu and President Harris are long dead. The king passed away in September 2006, aged 88, and René Harris in July 2008, having served four terms as president. Thinking now of my meetings with them in that millennium January, I am reminded that, now and again, events and people align in rare moments of serendipity.
John was one of those people who exude good humour. A handyman employed in the late 1990s to renovate the city centre Georgian building in which I was then the last remaining tenant. He nevertheless struck up an immediate rapport with me, winking behind the landlord's back, doing what little he could not to add to my woes, even as his hammering and dust-raising moved inexorably up through the building, through the very flat below I'd lived in previously, and ever closer to my present attic hideaway. These were the days of the Celtic Tiger, when the madly inflated value of city centre properties meant that buildings like ours were being turned into offices, and all of my former neighbours, one by one, had been forced to pack up and leave. My own days, too, were surely numbered. Even so, despite what might have been a gloomy atmosphere, John would show up for work most mornings whistling or singing, always with a glint in his eye and a ready yarn or witticism that might shorten his and help to brighten my day. That he worked with his hands while I sat upstairs trying to write in part explained our connection. There can be few writers who don't dream of and even romanticise physical labour, the wielding of hammers, the swinging of crossbars, the flattening of walls in a pleasing cloud of dust. And who's to say, but maybe every builder, like every taxi driver God knows, dreams of writing a tell-all book and retiring on the profits. And so we got on, swapping small talk and jokes whenever we met. And then one day, passing the open door of my previous flat, John called out to me. I thought by now I might have found some of that money you must have stashed away around here somewhere, he teased. And in a flash, I had it. The perfect plan, the perfect trick to take our gentle verbal sparring to the next level. That evening, after he'd gone with the building all to myself, back at the desk window with the sniper's view of government buildings, Chaz Mahal, they called it, when Charlie Haughey was still the main man there. The computer keyboard, half-finished manuscripts and books on Georgian architecture elbowed to one side. I set to work. As it happens, I had plenty of old newspapers to hand, saved up as kindling for the open fires of an otherwise unheated house. And a sharp knife cost only a few pounds on Baggot Street. And so it was that I began my criminal master plan, slicing and stacking until late into the night, when, with the addition of a single £5 note on top, my thick pile of freshly cut-up newspapers became a surprisingly convincing wad of cash. A ransom for a king, perhaps, or a bribe for a government official. The weekend passed uneventfully, and then on Monday, hearing movement below, around noon, I casually sauntered down, pretending to check for post, and as expected, bumped into John. "Well," I said with a grin, "nothing interesting lying around when you got in this morning, was there?" He looked at me blankly. "You didn't hear," he said, his voice taking on an unfamiliar tone. I wondered if it was part of an elaborate plan to get his retaliation in first. But before I could rerun the image I'd had in my mind of him reaching into the tool bag he'd left, as ever, in the empty room, he interrupted my reverie. "Someone broke in," he said. "Over the weekend, probably through the window on the flat roof there. Took off with my bag, they did, and all the tools in it. Half of them I'd only just got for this job." And we stood there then, facing each other on the stairs, the house a shell of its former self. And even as I started to explain, I could see him struggling to make sense of it, laughing and at the same time shaking his head in disbelief. Had the thieves, spotting the wad of fake banknotes, simply grabbed everything in sight and ran? Or were they already back home, back at burglar HQ, divvying up the spoils when someone reached into the bag and pulled out what was, for a moment only, the highlight of their careers? We laughed at that for sure. But then, after a time, with a shrug, him to his wrecking work, me to my brooding and hoping, we went our separate ways. The house I'd lived in then for years, and the city beyond it, already changed so utterly over those last few months, that thinking back again now, what happened to the money seems both the least important and the most resonant of mysteries.
The images and objects that signal Lourdes to me across the years are varied. Stone-shaped sweets, plastic Mary bottles filled with water, St. Bernadette, tiny shepherdess and visionary, a mountainy village, a rocky grotto, my father and brother smiling in photographs, wearing green ties, holding the handles of wheelchairs. And Lourdes was where my sister Nessa last travelled to, before cancer took her. The postcard she sent said, "It's like Blackpool meets the Vatican." I was brought up ultra-Catholic. As a child, I loved religious pageantry, singing, processions, incense, art and candles. Though a sporadic mass goer now, I've retained my love for those things. Also, my house is dotted with holy statues, and I like shrines, rag trees, blessed wells and prayer. Every year in Ballinasloe, I would see posters advertising the Clonfert Diocesan Pilgrimage to Lourdes. Every year I'd think I'd love to go on that. This year, I finally signed up. I've known the name Bernadette Soubirous since I was a child and was pleased the pilgrimage would bring me closer to her. Bernadette, I found out in Lourdes, was a bit of a rogue. Forthright and proud, she liked style and indulged in it despite illness, dire poverty,
and the squalor that her family endured when their milling business failed. The 18 apparitions of the Virgin Mary to Bernadette at the cave in Massabielle, Lourdes, changed the Subaru family's fate and that of their High Pyrenees village. Pilgrims flocking to Lourdes saw to that. I loved walking the ground Bernadette had walked, entering the three places she once lived, two small mills and the wretched-looking room known as Le Cachot, the dungeon of the former prison. The Maison Paternelle, now a museum, with its modest living area and gingham curtained beds, was where the Subaru family lived when Bernadette went away to a convent. The tiny museum is run by her family's descendants, and among the exhibits are Bernadette's checkered mouchoir, or headscarf, and a christening robe she embroidered that is worn by Subaru babies to this day. But the cave grotto at Massabielle is the beating heart of Lourdes. It sits beside the aqua-green River Gave and holds a palpable, uplifting calm. A statue of Mary was commissioned for the spot where Bernadette had her visions. The statue stands, hands clasped in prayer, wearing a white robe and blue sash, with a yellow rose on each foot. Bernadette grumbled that the statue didn't look like her lady. Too old, too tall. But the statue has stayed for 160 years regardless. Our pilgrimage priest, Father Pat Conroy, celebrated Mass for our group at the grotto. It was special to sit there, looking at the ivy, moss and buddleia that halo the cave, while our young music group sang in Irish. Ave Maria, Mora Ave, is Tussum Awahir, is Maher Day. And to listen to Father Pat, who, in his fair-minded, sincere way, told us that God loves us for who we are, as the human beings we are. An inclusive, welcome message. Lourdes post-pandemic has changed. There are shuttered up hotels and the crowds, I'm informed, are much reduced. But there were pilgrims galore and I loved witnessing so many united cultures worshipping in their unique ways. I saw Catholics from Africa in suits made of Holy Mary fabric, European preteens in nun-like veils and pale blue dresses, Indian pilgrims kneel walking on hard ground. I was awed by the volunteers and nurses from every country, giving up their time and energy, cheerfully and capably, to help the sick and infirm. They are earth angels for sure. It was a privilege to process by candlelight among them, under a dazzling sunset, and take part alongside the Bishop of Clonfert, Michael Dignan, in the International Mass in the vast underground Basilica of St. Pius X, and to share three hearty meals a day at the Hotel Mediterranee, where we all swapped stories and laughed. Some of us took a tour higher into the mountains, to the village of Gavarnie, a place ringed with white-capped peaks, and with a church statue aptly named Our Lady of the Snows. Did I come back with rosary beads, stone sweets, water-filled bottles and prayer cards from Lourdes? I did, by the dozen. But I brought home more than objects and images from Bernadette's village. I came back with something I think of as the Lourdes glow. Father Pat, at one of our gatherings, said, "Some providence brought each of you here to Lourdes." It's true. I have my reasons, connected to a journey I've been on for a few years, a walk towards light. Father Pat urged us to pay attention to Our Lady of the Elbow, who nudges us to heed what lingers quietly in our hearts. And Bishop Dignan advised us to try not to be imprisoned by sorry circumstances, but to become the person God intends us to be. I needed to hear, let in and mull over these things. And I'm grateful to the pilgrimage for helping me move further along. And to the Lourdes glow, part hope, part illumination, for lighting my path well.
Not long ago, I graduated from Drumshambo's FITEC course in traditional Irish music. The past 2 years in Leitrim seemed like a dream, a fairy story. 2 years packed with wonder and music. August 2022, the hottest summer on Inishmore for 30 years. I'd spent weeks applying for jobs and courses, wondering why at 49 I wasn't clear about what to do with the rest of my life. Wondering when I would hit that straight seam, a clear route forward imbued with meaning and purpose, a way to make a difference in a world that seems determined to distract us all to death. I was on a week-long Zen retreat, a deceptive description. Zen is more working holiday than relaxing break. I was camping in the garden of the retreat house, racing between the kitchen and the dojo, trying inconspicuously to check my phone, to keep an eye out for interview offers, when a message came in. Angela, are you still interested in doing the trad music course in Drumshambo this year? Start date 5th of September. All the best, Mossy. I read the text again and again. It had me perplexed. The traditional Irish music course is a full-time programme based in County Leitrim and a 4-hour drive from home. It was as if my heart had sent in an application while I was busy making plans. I replied politely to the text, convinced the sender had made a mistake. It didn't seem very official, and who on earth was Mossy? He didn't sound very academic. I said I couldn't do it, but perhaps if my circumstances changed, I'd reconsider the following year. My heart wouldn't agree to an outright refusal. During the course of the day, a memory drifted through the silent meditation, and it was all I could do to keep quiet. I pieced together the sequence of events. I'd always played the tin whistle on and off, and I'd Googled traditional Irish music courses before I left my job, before my husband's heart surgery, while the world was still shut down. I'd completed a form entitled Expression of Interest and was told the course was fully subscribed for the next 4 years. I put it out of my mind and moved to the next distraction. The heart surgery the previous year had confronted us both with the unpredictable nature of life. When I mentioned the text to my husband, he said simply, "There may never be a better time for this." The girls had finished college and were working. I didn't have a job to leave, and I hadn't, as yet, committed to an academic course. I called the number I now know belongs to the course tutor, an accomplished fiddle player with the Dartry Cayley Band, Mossy Martin. "I'm thinking about it, Mossy, but with a 4-hour drive, I'd need somewhere to live." "Funny you should say that," he said. And so I moved into digs with a harpist, Celia, whose cottage clings to the side of Slievan Éireann. It took a while to get used to it all. To fill the class kettle with holy water from the well. To learn music by ear. To get to grips with a concertina that had looked so straightforward. The trad course is as much a part of life in Drumshambo as the Joe Mooney Summer School or the rain. Our class played a Christmas concert with some of the Ukrainian community. Each of us hoping that peace would soon come to all caught up in war. We ended our academic year in May with a 2-week musical Erasmus trip to Vienna. I returned to Carlo with Austrian folk songs, Mozart's Ave Verum, and the new class tunes accompanying me home. Tunes that will be played and taught across the years in the North Connacht style in the small village of the Royal Oak, County Carlo.
Do you want to know what a porcupine smells like? Now, in the early days of the new year, already eager for spring, I'm reminded of the time a few years back when I snowshoed through the Canadian woods. I'm not really an outdoorsy person, but that day, teetering on snowshoes with a ski pole to steady myself, off to track coyotes, I felt about as intrepid as I ever will. We were only about 10 minutes from town, but you would never know that. The only sounds were those of nature, bird calls and the roar of the rapids where the ice on the river had started to melt. Canada is one of the largest countries in the world, yet 80% of the population lives within 100 kilometers of the US border, leaving almost 9 million square kilometers virtually empty. It is that sense of vast openness and isolation, the bush, that forms a large part of Canadian identity, and even the most urbane resident of Toronto or Montreal never feels far from the woods. Canoeing, hiking, and camping are second nature to most Canadians. It was March. We were coming off an extremely harsh winter that saw the temperature plummet to minus 30. But that day, it was just about zero, with fresh, soft snow on the ground, which made it easier for both snowshoeing and spotting animal tracks. Generally, I like my nature seen to the safety of a TV screen, and as I followed the coyote tracks, I wondered if the animal was nearby, and I wished I had David Attenborough to hand to narrate me out of this. My friend Hilary patiently waited for me to catch up, which I did with tremendous effort, as walking in snowshoes is much harder than it looks. Coyotes are extremely intelligent, and they've earned the name Wiley, she told me. The Roadrunner cartoons have done them a massive disservice. You should have been here last week. One crept right up on me, and I didn't hear a thing. I looked back at the trail. It was eerily peaceful. I remembered I hadn't told anyone where I was going, and the headline, "Irishman Eaten by Wolves," filled my mind. The tracks were in a straight line with a perfect 90-degree turn. A domestic dog will traipse all over, but a coyote doesn't waste energy, explained Hilary. Oh, look, she said, suddenly more excited. A beaver! Sure enough, down by the river was Canada's national animal, beloved by wildlife enthusiasts, but despised by landowners for the damage they do to trees. It had just felled a birch. It watched us for a little time before slipping off the ice and into the water. All around was evidence of wildlife. There were little arrows in the snow made by wild turkeys, hoof prints from deer and paw marks from a coyote. There was blood in the snow from where one had killed a rabbit. The wild dog proved elusive, prompting Hilary to suggest using her predator caller, a device that mimics the sound of animals in various states of anxiety. A frightened rabbit's scream filled the air. No response. So Hilary changed the setting to fawn in distress. Still no sign of the coyote, but I had nightmares about Bambi for weeks. On the drive back to town, I noticed a bird's head in the back of Hilary's car. Oh, that, she said blandly. I hit a partridge the other day. I chopped off his head for my skull collection. Skull collection? Her apartment looked like the back room of the Natural History Museum. There were the skulls of bats, birds, turtles, porcupines, and her most prized possession, the skull of a 300-pound bear. Hilary told me the cleaning process. I tie up the head outside, let the bugs pick it clean. I bleach it to remove any leftover germs, then dip it in hydrogen peroxide to whiten it. Sometimes I have to glue the teeth back in. I will never look at model glue the same way. Hilary was getting more excited. Look, bears have 42 teeth, but this old guy only had 37, and you can see where his canine got infected and it went right into the jaw. There was also a mouse's skull. Usually I wouldn't bother to keep such a tiny one, but you can see the perfect puncture wound from where the fox's tooth went in. I cast a worried glance at her two cats. Do you think it's an odd hobby? I asked her. Probably. I just find it an interesting way to learn about how animals live. Their teeth are broken, you can see cavities. At least it isn't as weird as taxidermy, she said, rolling her eyes. I don't stuff the things. Bones seem less creepy somehow. In the world of handling animal carcasses, skull collectors obviously regard taxidermists as out there, the same way that Trekkies might dismiss Babylon 5 fans as losers. It occurred to me it had been a death-filled afternoon. Not really, said Hillary. The world is hibernating at the moment. And when spring comes, there'll be young to care for. The porcupine didn't come out of her den because she's pregnant and far more cautious about being out. The porcupine's den, by the way, smelled of old socks dipped in cat pee with a gamey undertone. I won't be in a rush to smell it again. But if, like Thoreau, I went into the woods to live deliberately, I came out of them a little more respectful of the seeming peace that they offer.
Heligoland. Take God drawing life in faint outline, just blocking it in, all the time in the world. Out of the box of light a single photon escapes, a tiny sun in a dark universe. It charges on like a bold child and spreads itself out. It whips along the curves and tunnels of this new racetrack, until it meets a rose and slows down, enchanted. Then the necessary angel shifts her gaze. Space curls around her like a mink wrap. A river of particles rushes towards her and moves on. They sparkle. Heisenberg slips past, headed for Heligoland. When he looks back, there's a red rose pinned to the angel's cloak. For weeks he can't sleep. He will spend his first days on the archipelago, jotting it down, filling it in, riding the waves where they take him, to the cloak, the electric river, the impossible rose.
On this morning's programme, the new writing was Travelling Light, January 2000 by Joe Hayes. A Fool and His Money by Pat Boren. St. Bernadette's Lourdes, Impressions of a First-Time Pilgrim by Newell O'Connor. Journey to the Heart of Leitrim was by Angela Keogh. Skull and Bones by Niall McArdle. And Heligoland, a poem by Mary O'Malley. The music was I Just Want to Dance With You by Daniel O'Donnell. Take Five by the Dave Brubeck Quartet. Ave Maria, sung by Kiri Te Kanawa with the choir of St. Paul's Cathedral, featuring Thelma Owen on harp. The Mountaintop Reel was by Mossy Martin from his album The Humours of Derry na Cusan. And Winter Lady by Leonard Cohen, performed by Kate and Anna McGarrigal and Martha Wainwright. And some of this morning's writers have publishing news. Pat Boren's latest poetry collection is Hedge School, and that's published by Daedalus Press. The Shark Nursery by Mary O'Malley is published by Carr Canet. And Newell O'Connor's latest novel is published by New Island Books, and it's called Seaborn. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon, and the producer is Sarah Binchy. And of course, you can listen back on the RTE radio app and on all the usual podcast platforms. And you'll find more details about today's programme on Instagram, Facebook, and X. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.